From WXXI News in Rochester, this is Connections. I'm Scott Feibusch, in for Evan Dawson, and it is Summer Book Week, day two, the Tuesday of our Summer Book Week. And this hour, we are talking about publishers and publishing and editing, too. You think of the major literary capitals of the world, and what comes to mind first? New York City, London, Frankfurt. But how about Rochester? We've got some pretty interesting small presses here specializing in poetry, in works and translation, and some other great subjects. And we have some of the leaders of those presses in with us to talk to you this hour. We hope you'll join us, too, at 844-295-TALK, 844-295-8255. On Twitter, I'm at Scott Feibusch. And joining us this hour, Bruce Austin is here from RIT and the RIT Press. Chad Post is here from Open Letter Books at the University of Rochester. And Peter Connors is the founder and editor of BOA Editions. Thank you all for being with us today.
Thanks for having us.
Yeah, thanks.
And I want to start with you, Peter, because you're sort of the I don't want to say grandfather, godfather, perhaps, of small presses here in town. You're coming up on your 40th anniversary next year.
That's right. Yeah, BOA was founded actually by a poet and Brockport professor named Al Poulin Jr., who had a great flair for the dramatic and founded the press on July 4th, 1976. We're coming up on our 40th anniversary and have all sorts of big events planned and big doings for BOA.
We will talk about that more over the course of the hour. Chad, Open Letter Books is that most unusual of things. You specialize only in publishing works in translation.
Yes, we're one of a handful of presses that are doing only literature and translation, but we're one of the probably preeminent and most established at this point in time. We've been at the university for 8 years now, bringing out great titles from around the world.
And Bruce, tell us a little bit about RIT Press.
RIT Press is racing toward its 15th year of publication, and we're a scholarly publisher. We don't publish fiction and instead publish nonfiction representing all the academic disciplines at RIT, as well as a line of regional titles.
And we'll talk more, too, about some of your experiments and new forms of publishing, which I find absolutely fascinating. I want to start by discussing the industry in general. There was a survey that came out. The Association of American Publishers put their annual survey out just last month. $28 billion in publishing revenue nationwide in 2014. 2.7 billion units, which I guess would be a combination of books, audiobooks, ebooks that were all sold. A revenue increase of about 4.5% from the previous year. We're talking about a huge industry. How much of that is represented by small presses?
Nothing along the lines of those numbers, that's for sure. You know, I mean, small presses, generally, we do what we do because we have a passion for books that aren't as mainstream, you know, that don't necessarily get folded into those numbers. BOA focuses on poetry. We focus on poetry and translation, and we focus on short fiction of a highly literary variety. While we do have very dedicated readers and people who follow the press closely, it's hard to even really relate to those large industry numbers.
We, in terms of literature and translation, there's a different take on that question that you ask, is that out of all the books that are published in translation in the given year, which is a reasonably small number, but a number nonetheless, 75% of those books come from independent, small presses, university presses, and not from the Penguin Random House, HarperCollins, Simon & Schuster, Big Five. So in terms of my particular area of focus, the small presses are the leaders in that field. We are the ones opening up American voices to writers from around the world.
And as long as we're talking statistics here, there's a very good reason why your blog on your site is called 3%. Let's get that number.
Yeah,
out
so
there.
The 3% number comes from a few different sources. The most notable one is from Bowker back in 2005, did a study that said that out of all the books published in America at that point in time, which were 225,000 titles, 3% of them were originally written in another language. So this 3% statistic has stuck around and become a big kind of rallying cry for, you know, America has sort of isolated itself from the rest of the world and from the rest of these voices and ideas and concepts and areas by not having more books in translation. We have a translation database that sort of ties into this too, in which we track all the original works of fiction and poetry published in translation. So no new translations of Dostoevsky, no reprints of books that have been out of print, just the first time these books are available. And we've seen a large growth of the past 7 years from like, although large growth percentage-wise, in terms of actual numbers, it goes from like 360 to now 560. So there is more people doing more translations, but it's still that 3% number is very accurate.
Is that 3% by number of titles or by sales?
It's by number of titles.
Okay, so just Carl Ove Nausgaard by himself doesn't...
Yeah, he doesn't change it.
I think what the small presses do, regardless of the particular content that's being offered, is provide a particular service to a particular audience that tends to be relatively narrow and relatively shallow in terms of its numbers. And as a result, the small presses are providing a significant social, cultural, literary, scholarly set of texts to particular audiences that later on may disseminate a little bit more broadly to wider audiences. But we're the place, I think the three of us, if I can speak for us, we're the place at which selected authors can go to for their finely crafted but perhaps narrowly focused text.
Although I'd like to add something to that, is that with literary fiction in particular and poetry, I don't think there's a huge difference in sales numbers between the larger presses and presses like Open Letter or Boa Editions. When you're talking about like literature in that focus, those sales are pretty static. We tend to actually do better than a lot of large presses with our books because we have more effort put into them. They're distracted by doing 500 books a year, 400 of which are going to be massive books for them and cover a variety of different fields and topics of interest. Since we're solely focused on one thing, we're able to put a lot more energy into that. So when we've compared numbers with larger presses, they're not that much different. What tends to happen for our field, for literature, and I'm not speaking just about translation, but for literary writers, if they start out at a small press or an independent press and develop a reputation, like Knausgaard, whose new book was sold to Penguin, who's another example, Javier Marías, Roberto Bolaño, different poets that start out at small presses and gather a following, and then the big presses can pick them up and like expose them much wider than we have that ability to. But I think that initially those numbers aren't that much different.
Let's, if you don't mind putting some actual numbers to it, what is a good seller for you?
A good seller for the, well, our goal is to sell 3,000 copies of any given book in like an 18-month, two-year period. That is sometimes happens, usually in the 2,000 copy range, which is from like comparable to the New York Review of Books, and New Directions is slightly higher, but they're usually in that vein too. So,
yeah, I think, you know, for poetry titles, we sort of look at 1,000 books as a good baseline. If we hit that, then we're quite pleased. And you get authors who will go on and they'll sell maybe several thousand. You know, at BOA, we're fortunate to have a handful of authors like Lee Young Lee or Lucille Clifton or Naomi Shihab Nye, who sell in the tens of thousands of books. One of BOA's books that we published back in 1982, Rose by Lee Young Lee, is literally one of the best-selling poetry books ever published in this country. So what Chad is saying is absolutely correct in that, you know, especially I want to, you know, speak in terms of supporting small presses. If you care about writing, if you care about poetry, and if you care about fiction, then you should care about supporting small presses and buying small press titles, because without small presses, these writers have nowhere to go. I mean, this is absolutely where they start, and sometimes, you know, spend their whole career with us, which we love, and we can support them just as well. Sometimes you have an author who starts out at a small press, you know, gets stars in their eyes, will end up going to one of the big five presses and do a book and come back sort of with their tail between their legs and disappointed because guess what? Sales didn't matter. And guess what? You know, it turns out they didn't really care about my work and I was just a part of a cog in this larger machine. So the truth is that small presses are where the art is.
Let's talk a little bit about the economics behind it. Tell me if I'm off base with this analogy, but I'm thinking about what we're doing right here. You couldn't go to a big commercial radio station and say, hey, I want to spend an hour discussing books, much less an entire week discussing books, with a bunch of publishers of small presses that, you know, get maybe 1,000, 2,000, 3,000 copies sold. They say, oh, you'll never get ratings. You can't make money off of that. You guys, just like that, you're not trying to turn a profit on any of this, and you have other funding sources that you each turn to. And I want to start with you, Peter, because you're independent from any university, and you're out there functioning as a small nonprofit, right?
Yeah, and it can be confusing for people because we do sell our books. Our books are distributed across the country. You see them advertised in different places. So in many ways, BOA is a legitimate small business, and we have a small business model and so forth. On the flip side, we're creating a product that isn't like mass consumed. And so we're a nonprofit as well, and that means people can donate money to support our mission. That means we can apply for grants, whether they be government or foundation grants. Without that support, BOA would cease to exist, and what that means is all these artists, all these poets, all these writers that we publish lose an important venue for their work. So it is this dual business and nonprofit model that we work within.
You're getting by?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. No, there's with those numbers that you gave, as much as I can say, you know, we're sort of divorced from those numbers, those large inflated numbers. But the truth is there's a lot of people out there who passionately care about poetry. They passionately care about literary fiction and art, and also seeing books in translation. And those are the people who know to come to BOA to look at what we're publishing or to go to our other sister small presses. And it's important. If you believe in these things, then you need to support the organizations that put them out.
There's another misperception along the lines of what you're talking about being a small press and being national, which is very much the case. Like, we're much more well-known in New York and in San Francisco than anywhere else, and Portland. But the other misconception about nonprofit publishing is that it can't turn a profit. You can make as much money as you want to as a nonprofit as long as that's reinvested into your mission. So it's mission-driven first, not profit-driven. But you can make a lot of money through grants, donations, sales, as long as that keeps feeding back in. And a good example is like the Minneapolis Press's Coffee House, Milkweed, Grey Wolf. And Grey Wolf in particular, when they had Pierre Patterson book Out Stealing Horses, made it to the bestseller list. They made a ton of money. They sort of ramped up their whole business by reinvesting that into expanding their staff, expanding their acquisitions, doing more for marketing, and became an even larger player in the whole literary field or book field by being able to reinvest that money. So we all depend upon these grants, upon individual donations. And it's usually like a 40-60 split between sales and donations going either way. But that is, you can make money and just get it back.
How much support do you get from the university, Bruce?
We get a fair amount of support, but that's primarily in terms of space and facilities from the university. So like the others, we're not for profit. We accept donations, but that doesn't mean we seek to run at a deficit. Our print runs of 750 to 1,250 copies, selling at a reasonable price, an affordable price to our readership, means that if we sell out, we can earn back the money that we put into producing the book. So the university will be subsidizing things other than the actual production. The author gets some compensation for his or her work, and we get the word out on a particular subject to that select group of individuals.
All right. It is Connections Summer Book Week here on member-supported public radio. I'm Scott Feibusch. In for Evan Dawson this hour, we are talking about publishing and editing here in Rochester with Bruce Austin from the RIT Press, Chad Post from Open Letter Books over at the U of R, and Peter Connors, the founder and editor of BOA Editions, and with you as well, 844-295-TALK, also on Twitter, at Scott Feibusch. And Ricky in Rochester, you are on Connections with a question about translation.
Oh, hi. Thank you for having me on. I recently purchased a translated book. I think it was from the Open Letters, The Physics of Sparrows. And I just found it to be completely magical. I mean, it was unlike anything you get in English. I mean, it was like rainbows or pyramids or magnets. There's just this magic all around it. And I was wondering, how do you pick these books that are from different languages? Do you look for this, like, inherent magic in them that makes them different from what's in English?
I just want to jump in first. You should see the smile on Chad's face right now.
The book you're talking about, Physics of Sorrow by Gorgi Gospodinov, he's a wonderful Bulgarian writer. And the way that we find a lot of books, there's a number of different ways this comes together. But by attending things like the Frankfurt Book Fair, the London Book Fair, by working with international agents, we get a lot of submissions. And we get a lot of submissions from translators who provide us with descriptions and then samples. And we can read 20, 50 pages of the book, a good write-up about it, sometimes talk to people from that speak that the language of that original, and sort of make a decision, because we are looking for that special, unique thing that's not currently available in whatever form that is. So we want to expand. One of my beliefs in terms of why literature and translation is important is that it allows the American world of letters to expand a bit by seeing new perspectives. And so we're looking for those things that are unique or strange, like Physics of Sorrow, that is a wonderful, brilliant book that has a structure that's unlike most other things you would see in your everyday American book, I guess, which isn't to disparage American literature. American literature is great. I just think there is more things that are out there as well.
Thanks.
Yeah, I thought it was really great. I mean, I don't read a whole lot, but it was very different from what I normally read. And then when I was reading that while listening to like Huber Spank or Pink Floyd, it just was really cool. Like, I just thought you guys did a great job. Keep it up. I want to encourage you.
Thank you. If I can ask you a question, Ricky, how did you find the book?
Actually, I just had a buddy that retweeted that somebody had tweeted, that I think Chad retweeted about Open Letter Press, and I found it through Twitter.
Excellent. Thanks so much for the call. I appreciate it. This kind of brings me to the question I was going to ask about how you get the word out, you know, in the face of just the sheer number of titles that are coming out year after year. I went over to pick up some books from Peter couple of weeks ago, and I walked in and he said, here, we've got this entire bookcase here. What are you interested in? And it's overwhelming. You know, if you don't know the authors, if these are titles that aren't necessarily getting covered, I guess the New York Times Book Review and New York Review of Books are pretty much most of what's left as far as mainstream book reviewing these days. How do you get the word out now?
I think one place is through librarians, which used to be a huge market for scholarly books. It's greatly diminished these days. So through librarians, we're able to access, especially university libraries. We also look to particular kinds of traditional printed media as well as more contemporary forms of media, given the special topic that we're looking at. We have a title coming out that we're distributing from the New York State Museum on decorated stoneware from the 19th century. Well, that title we want to publicize through various art and antique publications in order to reach the audience that we think is going to have the greatest amount of interest in that. We also are active in social media. We could do a little bit better on social media. And I think, like many publishers, the elephant in the room is Amazon, so we also distribute through Amazon.
Yeah. We're on quite of a roll right now. We had a couple of books reviewed in the same issue of the New York Times, which is one of the primary places to get the word out. And then James Wood just wrote an article for The New Yorker on Alejandro Zambra and included the book of his that we published. And then yesterday we got the National Translation Award, which is one of the longest running awards for translation in the country, announced their prose long list of 12 titles, and we have 4 books on there, so like 33%, all of which doesn't matter as much as the retweets and the reshares. I'm writing an article for Publishing Perspectives about this right now, that frequently it seems that the way that you increase sales is by having that base of Twitter followers. When you retweet it, they retweet it, things become exponential, and people just see it, and it sticks to them. It's not so much that they're reading that review, it's that they're aware that that review and that book are a thing that is important. And once it comes up enough times, like the old school marketing ideas, once you see it enough, then it sticks and you feel like you have to have it. But creating that sort of desire, I think, comes through a lot of chatter, more so than the actual content. But the actual content is absolutely like the crucial first layer. And booksellers love these sort of books. And booksellers are like librarians, like you say, librarians are fantastic. And booksellers are the same way, where they're actively like promoting things and helping shift literary culture and shape it by what they're displaying.
Assuming you can find a bookseller. I grew up here in town, yeah. as you know, and I remember the days of having Babar's Books at 12 Corners, mm-hmm. and I remember literally the week that Village Green opened and going down there, and they were just in the front part there, and the bookstores that were at what's now Village Gate.
Someday.
How do you deal with this? I mean, Liftbridge, who's sponsoring us this week with the show, and we're much appreciative of that. Is there an era still where these small bookstores can survive, and how do you work with them? I heard you mentioning Powell's before in Portland, which is probably the biggest independent that's still out
huge.
There.
Huge, yeah. There's a lot of actually independent bookstores are sort of on the rise again, and there's an increase in attention, especially in the large cities, the Chicago's, Portland, San Francisco, New York, the obvious big cities. have enough support where they can survive, and they're actually becoming more trendy again. One of the things that we do is, thanks to this guy, Jeff Waxman, who's a former bookseller in Chicago and works for other press, is I participate in a number of independent press nights at bookstores where we'll go to, last one was in San Francisco, to Green Apple on the Park, and invite all the booksellers and librarians from San Francisco to come, of which there's probably was like 30, 40, 50 of them. We buy them pizza and beer, and then each of six different presses presents like four titles of why we're most excited or what we're most passionate about, and then they go forth and sell those, and we mingle and work with them. It's a very personal relationship, and that's books have always been like a face-to-face personal relationship, and that does make the big difference.
Yeah, I think that we're definitely benefiting from the whole like buy local movement, you know, and as Chad said, buying books and being a reader and going to bookstores, it's a very much a personal experience. And what we do as small presses fits right in with that. I mean, we're not mass-produced products, right? We're personal products. So independent bookstores tend to really value what small presses do. Even though Bo is based in Rochester, our authors are all over the country. They're all over the world. So on any given night, there is a BOA author reading in a bookstore somewhere in this country. And a lot of what we found is that somebody might be intimidated by poetry. You know, they don't know what to make of it. Maybe they had a bad experience in high school or something like this, you know, that turned them off. You put them in the room with a poet who's reading, and it will completely change their experience, and it will change their feeling about poetry. So a lot of what we do is make sure that the books are available, that we support our authors getting out there and giving readings and getting to people one at a time. You know, and going back to how you spread the word, too, it's funny. When I was first hired by BOA, I was hired as marketing director, and I had to create a MySpace page for us. And then I had to learn how to make press kits, which was in an envelope, you know, with a 5x7 author photo and clippings of different reviews, and they would be pasted together. So I think social media has just completely revolutionized independent publishing. It's been the best thing that I've seen happen in the past decade. And the fact is that our books do get reviewed nationally consistently. The trick is to get those reviews then out to people who can read them and respond and buy the books, so forth. So, yeah, social media has been amazing. And just the fact that our authors are everywhere out promoting their work.
Are you able to actually fund book tours the way that a larger publisher might?
We can support authors' travel somewhat. We don't have the budget to actually fund book tours, and I wish we did. You know, that's one of those things Chad said, like we can put money that we have excess and put it back into the business. And I would love to be able to have money to just set aside to support book tours. We're not at that level, but hopefully with our 40th anniversary fundraising campaign, we can get there.
The scholars at RIT Press are attending professional conferences, discipline-based conferences, and that's a way that they can represent their titles without doing the book tour for us. We can also have books at those professional conferences, and we found that by participating as vendors in one sort of public event or another, that's a great way to get exposure for our authors and for our titles. So, for example, in October, we're going to be at the APHA, the American Print History Association's conference that RIT happens to be hosting. And in September, we're participating in the Rochester Antiquarian Book Fair. Not so much to sell books. We're glad to do that, and we'll have books available, but rather to make the acquaintance of readers and also potential authors for RIT Press. So we find a lot of benefits in what was described earlier as a rather personal way of doing business while still maintaining relationships with traditional bookstores, albeit our bookstores tend to be as specialized as our titles are. So they may be in museums, for example.
Do you find that you benefit? I imagine you have authors coming in who probably already have some sort of following within whatever their specialized topic area is. Is it more appealing to you if somebody comes in and says, you know what, I've got 2,000 people following me on Twitter who would probably immediately be interested in this book? Does that?
I'll meet you this afternoon on that. Yeah. Yes, absolutely. That would be very, very welcome. But some of the authors that we have, social media is kind of a novelty to them. Yeah. As it is to me, too. I mean, it's not something that I grew up with. It's something that, truth be told, I have to force myself to do. But those authors that are coming in recognize the significance of not self-promotion, but promotion for their work, for their title, for their scholarship, as a way of broadening their reach. And we have had authors where we do a 500 to 800 copy press run, and almost immediately have to do a reprint on it. I mean, those are the authors that we love to have, the books that we love to have, and the authors are very pleased, as are, by the way, the readers of their books.
Mm-hmm. Excellent. We are talking about publishing here in Rochester and by extension around the country and around the world with Peter Connors from BOA Editions, Bruce Austin from RIT Press, and Chad Post from Open Letter Books, and you as well at 844-295-TALK or on Twitter at Scott Feibusch. We will be back with more after a quick break here at member-supported public radio, AM 1370, FM 88.5 and 91.5 HD2 in Rochester, 89.5 in the Finger Lakes, online at WXXI.org or in the WXXI mobile app. In hour two of Summer Book Week on Connections, David McCullough is one of the most prominent historians in America. You know him from his Pulitzer Prize-winning Truman and John Adams. Now he's turned his attention to the most famous inventors you probably don't know that much about, the lives and talents of the Wright brothers. Ahead with David McCullough, it's in our second hour today on Connections.
Each day, All Things Considered brings you unparalleled insight into the latest news. We interview experts who have deep knowledge on topics of the day, who have the skills to explain. We unravel complex issues that sometimes seem too hard to grasp. I'm Melissa Block. Join us every afternoon for All Things Considered from NPR News.
This afternoon at 4 on WXXI.
It is Summer Book Week on Connections here on member-supported public radio. I am Scott Feibusch in for Evan Dawson all week. We are talking with Peter Connors, the founder and editor, or the editor, I should say, you didn't actually found it, of BOA Editions, but you've been with it for quite a while. Chad Post from Open Letter Books at the U of R and Bruce Austin from RIT Press and you as well at 844-295-TALK, 844-295-8255. On Twitter, I am at Scott Feibusch. And I want to begin the second part of the show by asking specifically about being here in Rochester. You've all talked about how you draw your authors nationwide and around the world and how your audiences come from nationwide and around the world. What's the value? What's the importance? What are some of the positives and negatives of being here in Rochester? I'll start with you, Bruce.
I think it's a bookish community. We have a number of universities and cultural institutions that support books and the book arts. They support their authors, their eager readers, their interested readers, and their curious readers. So I think for RIT Press, being nested in the context of Rochester, New York, as well as the rich regional history that we can tap into for some of our titles, makes for a very rewarding experience. The press came out of what was then called the School of Printing at RIT, and it was driven primarily by that discipline at the very beginning. What the Institute has allowed us to do, however, is to broaden our editorial scope considerably while still retaining the scholarly label and include the regional titles. And so for me, Rochester represents, and has always represented, a strong, cultural, curious, interested group of individuals who tend to be very supportive of all the many different organizations we have here.
That's true. I mean, our great benefit is being at the University of Rochester, where there is a literary translation program, both for undergraduates and for graduate students. So we've created in Rochester like a very solid hub of translation-related people, not just the students that come through the program to get their master's degree, but there's a number of like world-class translators who happen to live in this area, including like Linton Smith, who's like the top Icelandic translator, Carrie Pierce, who does like Norwegian, Swedish, Danish, and many other languages. Kaya, our editor, Kaya Strominis, does Latvian and German. And that's been really beneficial to us, is to have that home. But I think one thing that's great about Rochester, too, is by not being New York, it's affordable. Like, it is a place that a lot of these presses that are doing something that's, very utopic in scope or quixotic in scope, like you can succeed because you're not paying $7,000 a month to have a one-bedroom or one-room office in Manhattan. So there is that benefit to it. The drag on it is that we don't run into the reviewers of our books on a daily basis at various parties, but still we're doing okay.
Every time I think what I do is obscure, I'm going to remember that somewhere out there is a top Icelandic translator.
Yeah. Hey, he's the best. He translated Jan Gunnar, the former mayor of Reykjavik, who came here as part of our Reading the World Conversation series. And Lynn's translated him. And Jan Gunnar, if anyone doesn't know, is probably the only person in the world who's been praised by both Lady Gaga and Noam Chomsky. So, good start.
Peter?
Yeah, you know, it's interesting for BOA because you can travel pretty much anywhere in the country, and if you speak to somebody about poetry, they're going to know BOA editions. And frankly, especially as the next generation comes up in poetry, chances are a BOA book was their gateway drug into poetry. You know, we were one of the first books that they read. We were we sponsored one of the first authors that they went to see at a reading. But sometimes it can be hard to let people in Rochester know that we're here because our authors are all over the place. And BOA isn't a place that people go to. You know, we do what we do in our small office and we send it out into the world. So that's a challenge that we face here in Rochester, is just letting people know this is a world-class art institution that's right in your city that we'd love you to be more aware of. You know, that said, Rochester is really a sexy city in a lot of ways because people who read are sexy. They're interesting. They have things to say. I always tell people, you know, it's like you can go to the gym, you can get yourself looking good, you can do all that. But if you really want to be sexy, if you really want to be interesting, take an hour less at the gym and go read a book. And there's a lot of sexy people in Rochester who are reading, who have really interesting, intelligent thoughts, and BOA helps make them sexier.
Wait till you read Louise Worm Leonard's new book that we were talking with her about yesterday.
I heard that. Yeah.
Yeah, that definitely fits the conversation. Go to the phones here at 844-295-TALK and on Twitter as well at Scott Feibusch. And Daniel, you're listening in California, huh?
Yeah.
Whereabouts in California?
In San Francisco.
Excellent. Welcome to the show.
Yeah. Thank you. So this is a question for Mr. Post. I was just curious, are you aware that by publishing foreign authors, you're taking away American jobs?
Taking away from American writers? Well, that's not, not exactly, because almost all of our translators are based in America. So the translators we're creating a lot of opportunities for a lot of translators that otherwise wouldn't exist. And that is actually like a secondary part of our enterprise, and that other presses are helping with as well, is that not just are we, you know, helping introduce different authors from around the world, but there's a lot of very gifted translators who are flying underneath the radar. Like you're talking about book readers being sexy. Translators are very sexy too and are doing something that's very unique, but generally fairly invisible, and we help try and bring some attention to those people.
Okay. The phone number is 844-295-TALK. I've never thought about it that way. It's a very, very interesting question there.
There's been some sentiments like that over time.
A shout out on Twitter from our friends over at Writers and Books who say they're listening to us in every office today. And we should mention Joe Flaherty will be on with us on Thursday's show talking about his long career helping to support Writers and Books here in Rochester and all the great work that they do over there. I'm very much looking forward to that conversation as well. I want to talk a little bit about some of the new forms of publishing. You know, a lot of those units that were in that study that we talked about at the beginning of the show were audiobooks and ebooks. And Bruce, you're doing some things over there that are kind of stretching the boundaries of what we think of when we think of a book, right?
We're not doing audiobooks, but we have done ebooks, and most of our publications as they come out are now available in e-format as well. I think one of the most interesting things, though, is an enhanced ebook format. And we have an example from the Vignelli Transit Maps title that we did a number of years ago. So rather than literally turning from page to page to look at Massimo Vignelli's development of the transit maps for New York City, you can wipe on and off, see from pencil sketches to final print, the development of his creative process in putting together the transit maps. It's labor-intensive, time-intensive, and it's expensive to do, but for selected titles, we think that that's going to be enormously significant and that some readers are going to find that enormously beneficial and are going to be willing to pay for it, too.
Is this something platform-specific, just iPad or available?
Yeah, iPad only, for us only at the moment. Despite being at the Institute of Technology, we don't have all of the staff yet to expand to the capacity that technology will currently afford. That's on its way, but not today.
I was going to ask, staffing-wise, I know you're all operating with relatively tight staffing levels. Peter gave me a tour of his office. You've got, what, four people over there, five?
Melissa Hall and Jenna Fisher and I are the three members at BOA, yeah, three.
Wow.
And interns,
and
which interns. We love our interns, yeah. And there are, you know, it's worth mentioning, too, that there are internship opportunities, I know, at BOA, and I'm sure at the other presses as well, for local college students or sometimes graduate students, maybe even a mature high school senior, to come and be an intern at one of our organizations to help out, to learn a lot about publishing and literature.
A big thank you to our intern, Caitlin Madison, who helped pull this whole segment together today. She's been fantastic, and she got us all turned on. We've had a conversation going now about graphic novels that we're going to be talking about on Thursday that she sort of started the whole newsroom going on now that we're excited about. How big is your staff, Chad?
We have three full-time people as well, myself, Kai Strominus, and Nathan Furl. And then we work a lot with the students at the university. We have summer interns, and then also some other aspects of the university, obviously, that help support us for infrastructure. Pretty small.
I wanted to ask, for you particularly, and we'll get to all of you, about how submissions come in and what it is that each of you are looking for from writers, but with translations particularly, does it come into you typically as a package with a translator saying, I've read this and I want to bring this to you, or do you find a translator?
It's half and half. We'll get certain books that come in, like this book, Rochester Knockings, that comes out in October, which is about Rochester, New York, and about the Fox sisters and spiritualism. Ooh. That came in from the French publisher as, here's an author we think you'd be interested in, plus it's about where you are based. And Jen Groats, who's a well-known poet and professor at the University of Rochester and head of the translation program right now, she read it and loved it and wanted to translate it. So she did a sample. We went through the sample and talked about it and agreed that it was like the right voice. And so she went ahead with it. Other books come in with translators associated with them from the start, where that translator is the one bringing us that book to our attention and saying, here, I've read this, you'll love it. I know you guys, you're going to just die for this. Here's a bunch of pages. And then we go from that way. But it really is about half and half.
844-295-TALK is the phone number, on Twitter at Scott Feibusch. Peter, how does material come into you? How do you deal with the volume that comes into you?
We have a couple different ways that things come in. We have open submission periods for some of our series, which means there's like a month when people can just submit any work that they want for poetry and translation or fiction. We also have two contests that we do. We have one coming up starting on August 1st. That's the A. Poulin Jr. Poetry Prize Contest, and that is for authors who haven't published a book of poetry before. It's the only way that BOA will publish a first book of poetry, but it has produced some amazing first books and launched a lot of careers. So that starts on August 1st. We have a short fiction contest, and then we have open reading periods. For our translations, they tend to come in already done from the translator, but there's all sorts of different ways. And basically, if you go to boaeditions.org, we have a whole submissions link section that you can see all the different submissions information.
You were telling me, is that the contest that you read everything yourself for?
The fiction contest is, yeah. It's interesting because right now in my office, there's several hundred manuscripts that are sitting and waiting to be read. So that's a large part of what I do. And sometimes people say, like, what do you like to read? I usually don't read things with spines. You know, I usually read manuscript pages, and which I love, you know, because basically you're on a treasure hunt. You're looking for that one piece of writing that's going to just light you up and that you know this is what your mission is as a publisher. You were meant to find that particular book because it's so perfect and because it's so deserving and because it fits your press's mission so well. And that drives me. You know, it drives me through a lot of different pages. And when you find that, you just light up and you know you're supposed to bring this into the world.
And are you reading those on paper or electronically? Or
I read them on paper. You know, it's an interesting, when you started to get into, I thought we were going into sort of an ebook discussion.
And I do want to get back to that.
Yeah, and it's, you know, especially when ebooks started to come on the scene. BOA was actually one of the first small presses, particularly for poetry, that started to put all our books out as ebooks, and we still do that. But interestingly, we speak to college professors or college students and so forth because these are the folks who were supposed to be only reading things in ebook. It turns out they're not. It turns out they really want that finished book a lot of time. So while all our books are available as ebooks, most of our sales come through print books, which is great because a lot of our books feature local visual artists as well. We have a BOA visual art library that's stocked with all local visual artists that we are able to create through grants from the Rochester Arts and Cultural Council. And so we put a lot of time and effort. Our designers are all local. The cover artists are local. So we put a lot of time and effort into the look of, the physical look of our books as well. So I'm very pleased, you know, that people are still buying the physical books.
Do you do any audiobooks?
We haven't gotten into audiobooks. A lot of our authors will have, we're seeing this more and more. They'll do like little short films that they'll post online. We have a book coming out by a very well-known poet named Aristeles Guirmé. The book is The Black Maria, and she has a whole film, like a short film that goes along with the book. So increasingly, you see artists working across genres and doing things to support their work that way.
We were talking about that with Louise yesterday, too. She's got a trailer up for her book, Charles Benoit, who we're talking to tomorrow, has essentially a little short movie trailer.
Yeah,
for his book, Chad, you do any books?
We have one of those too. Yeah, for most, initially when we started, when ebooks started, there were some complications with dealing with foreign publishers and foreign agents in terms of what they wanted percentages to be. They were scared if you print an ebook, everyone will download it; it'll be stolen by every person in the world. That has dissipated. So now, going forward, like 80 to 100% of all of our books we have the e-version available. But like you said, most in my classes that I teach at the university, almost no one reads the e-books. And our percentage is like 16% of our overall sales will be the e-version versus when you just compare the print and e, 16% will be e and the rest will be print. So it's still pretty modest. And I don't know, there's been like, you're starting to go in the e-books. There's been like a number of studies recently where the e-book increase has kind of plateaued in a lot of things. It's sort of stopped growing at this point and is becoming fairly steady, which is probably healthy in the long run.
You're doing a podcast over there too, right?
We do a podcast. That is true. We don't do audiobooks yet, but we do a podcast called the 3% Podcast that Tom Roberge from New Directions and Albertine Books in New York and I do every other week to talk about book issues, a lot of sports, various ranting. It's kind of a mixed bag.
Was that where you had Lost tied into it too?
Was
that
Lost is separate. Lost was Lost has been on my mind because my children and I have been watching it recently and loving it. But back in, oh my God, when would it have been? Years ago, 2005, 2006, one of the books at the press that I used to work for, Delkey Archive Press, this book, Third Policeman by Flann O'Brien, was on the show Lost on the third episode of the second season. And because we made such a huge publicity deal out of this and talked about how it would, you know, reveal secrets about what was going on the island, we sold 15,000 copies in 3 weeks, which was astronomically fast and good for the press, and ended up where I got involved a lot with the writers from Lost and helped pick a few books that ended up on the show, a number of them. And we used to do a weekly top 40 radio show together with in Bloomington, Normal, Illinois, where we talk about the books on Lost and the literary aspects of Lost. So it was like the one time when you mentioned that you can be on radio. It was, if you use like a, you know, the most popular TV show in the country, then you can slide books in there.
As long as you got the hook in there. Yeah. Bruce, you were starting to.
I was going to say that the recent AAUP, the University Publishers Survey of Revenues, indicates that ebooks are about 10 to maybe 12% of the market. Mm-hmm. I don't think anybody doubts that that number will go up. We're not quite sure perhaps how high it will go. But one of the interesting things that I find is that among our authors, they want their book in e-format, but they want the printed copy.
Yeah.
They most assuredly want the printed copy. It might be fair to say they demand the printed copy. One of the interesting things, however, that's happening in e-formats in university presses as well as commercial publishers is slicing and dicing. And I think that has significance both for how books or book-like material is presented, selling a chapter at a time, for example, or you pick which chapters of the 20 you would like to own and we'll sell them to you, as well as what it means to the writer. So how do you compose knowing that your reader didn't necessarily read the introduction and won't necessarily read the conclusion chapter either? What does that mean for the chapters as you construct them? And I think that's an interesting, not problem, but question that the industry and the writers, the authors, have to wrestle with.
Which kind of rewinds you all the way back to the days when Dickens was coming out chapter by chapter in the newspapers.
Yeah, and the last time Tom Wolfe's tried that, it didn't work out too well, as I recall.
We had a question come in offline about women in publishing. Are you? I mean, we've got three guys sitting here. Yeah. Are you comfortable with where things stand right now with getting more women and minorities into the business?
It's a huge problem. It is a hot topic, and it is something that is very important that there needs to be more women involved in publishing at more senior roles. Although there have been numerous examples of very famous and great publishers that are women, Jane Friedman, Elaine from City Lights, like very important figures. We're doing a study that will release in a couple months about the number, shifting it slightly from like the working and publishing aspect to the books and the book publications of how many books in translation are published by male authors versus female authors. And I can tell you from the preliminary results that 71% that came out over the past 8 years were by male authors, written by males, which is way out of balance. But there are a lot of women who work in publishing. It's just there can be more, and there could be more equal in terms of power.
At RIT Press, we are a staff of four, including myself, and I'm the only male. I don't know what the numbers are at the national level for that, but at the national conferences, heavy population by women, substantial showing. That may not translate, I don't know, but that may not translate to directors of university presses, however. Many, many women who are managing editors, for example, also designers. And if you move into publicity, marketing, and promotion, then it's very loaded in the direction of women.
Yeah, it's worth mentioning there's an organization called VIDA, V-I-D-A. Much as Chad has done with cataloging where translations are published and who's publishing them, VIDA's whole role is to follow publications by women and to see their representation in different literary journals and book publishing and so forth. So it's worth, if somebody's interested in that topic, it's worth going online and looking up VIDA and seeing exactly what those numbers are.
V-I-D-A. I want to, as we get towards our final minutes of the show here, I want to give each of you a chance to talk up one thing we should be reading from your presses in the upcoming months. Who wants to go first?
Go for it, Peter.
Well, actually, can I promote something else?
Go for it.
No, I will say we don't do a lot of local events, so I'm really excited to have two authors, both with new books out. Nicole Brown and John Gallagher are actually coming to town on September 20th to give a reading. It's our annual Dine and Rhyme event. So they'll give a reading. There'll be a reception at Good Luck Restaurant. The reading is at the Memorial Art Gallery. Again, it's on September 20th. And I say this because they both have new books out. But again, if you're not familiar with poetry, if maybe you're a little intimidated, or if you just want to try something culturally different, come out to the event. Come and listen to these poets read their work. You will have a transformative experience, I guarantee you, and it'll give you a chance to meet and mingle and touch base with everybody at BOA as well.
Evan, I know you're listening on the podcast over there on your vacation. Book them. Get them in here September 20th. That'll be a good show, too.
And so we have two events that'll tie into this, too. On September 10th, Andres Newman, who was blurred by Roberto Bolaño as his quote about Andres was, "Good readers will find something that can only be found in great literature in the works of Andres Newman and his compatriots." Andres had two books that came out from FSG, a massive publisher, and we're doing his new book, The Things We Don't Do, and he'll be in town on September 10th to give a reading at the Buddha Pub. And then on October 23rd, we're going to have a big celebration at the German House right above the Buddha Pub for Rochester Knockings, which if there's one Rochester, maybe this is the book that you guys were looking for yesterday of like the Rochester novel. It's about the history, the 1840s to 60s when spiritualism took over and these three sisters conned everyone and launched a thousand mystics.
We are still looking for that Rochester novel, so yeah, that might indeed be it. Tweet me at Scott Feibusch if you've got some other suggestions for what the Rochester book or the Rochester novel could be. Bruce, what do you have coming out, which people will be reading?
RIT Press just released Armando Milani's book, which is entitled No Words Posters. It's a collection of 200 posters from the late 1950s until around 2012, many of them with a social consciousness and none of them with any words. So the message is delivered graphically as opposed to some sort of a text. We have a title coming out on the Aries Press of Eden, New York, which was a small private press in the late 1920s that used William Morris's Kelmscott Press as the printing press to produce the books. And that should be out late fall. And then we also have a title on Centaur Bruce Rogers type font. We thought we were going to have that in just moments, and we're waiting for the font for the book to come through. So that's going to be at the very beginning of 2016.
Will it be set in Centaur?
No, not in Centaur, in a new font that's been developed by the authors for the title.
Okay.
So it's a pretty exciting project, and will be a beautiful book.
I'm a typeface geek, so I'll be looking forward to that. we're down to the final minutes here, and I wanted to spend more time on this, but real quickly, self-publishing, is it any kind of threat to what you guys do?
It's not really a threat to what we do for Open Letter, but what's interesting is that it does create that perception that you mentioned earlier when you went into Beau's office and saw the big wall of books. That is one of the things of cutting through that noise. This is a lot. Now there's still like 300,000 books that come out from traditional publishers and like 2 million self-published books that are coming out and available either just as in like the ebook format or in print and ebook. But, you know, how do you get through that? For us personally, the one thing that we've done is we launched the Best Translated Book Award 8 years ago that helps, or 7 years, no, 8 years ago now, that's for translations to sort of cut through that noise and try and highlight the best of the best. But yeah, it's an issue.
We're trying to do some highlighting as well. You can find our summer reading list at WXXINews.org and click on Summer Book Week. Summer Book Week will continue in just moments with our conversation with David McCullough. Our thanks to Val behind the board and to Peter Connors from BOA Editions, Chad Post from Open Letter Books, and Bruce Austin from the RIT Press. I'm Scott Feibusch. This is Connections from member-supported public radio.